Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast with me, Simone. I had somebody recently reach out and say that I was their Nutcracker Syndrome virtual bestie, and I loved that so much. So I'm just going to claim that. I love that. If you need me to be your virtual best friend through this process, count me in. And for this episode, I want to talk about the medications that helped my nutcracker syndrome. I'm going to reiterate that this is my lived experience with nutcracker syndrome. So the medications that helped me might be medications that you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. That actually did not help me at all. It made me worse. And that is completely valid. So before we get this episode started, I'm shaking I call myself a Walgreens satellite location because these are all my pills in a pretty massive bag. And I feel like my own pharmacy. Maybe some of you all feel that way, just bottles on bottles, you know? So I'm gonna go through kind of quickly the medications that did help me. Some initially helped, and then, as we all know, they help in the beginning, and then we become either like, what's the word? It's early morning for me, as I'm taking a couple sips of coffee, but not immune to it. But it just gets to where it's not really helping us that much. So I'll kind of talk about that journey that I've been on, the things that helped me, the things that really didn't, but some of the kind of suggestions that I have along the way. Big macro level point of view before we get into the micro level drugs. I say yes. Like, if my primary care doc was like, "Do you want to try this?" I just said yes. That didn't mean that I was going to actually do the drug. That just meant that we all know how stressful it is to ask a primary care doctor, or any doctor for that matter, for a prescription. Okay. And some of them are more stingy than others. Thankfully, Dr. Ryan Thompson at Littleton Advent Health in Denver area is amazing. He was very much like, "What can I do to help you? Tell me." And he was very giving, you know, within parameters. We'd obviously talk about, like, if I was on an opioid or an addictive anti-anxiety med, we would talk about, like, okay, what is our goals with this? So we were definitely ethical about it. But with that being said, anytime he would suggest something that he was thinking for me, I just said yes, because we all know that sometimes that's just the first barrier to getting a medication, is a doctor saying, "Sure, I'll prescribe it." So I would just say yes, and I would always go to Walgreens to pick it up. I'm still picking up, as an example, just yesterday, I get a call from Walgreens, and it's like, "You have a prescription ready to pick up." I'll be honest with you, I had no idea what this prescription was. Like, I haven't been to the doctor recently. I'm 4.5 months post-op from my kidney auto transplant at this point, but by golly day, did I go to Walgreens and pick up that damn medication. And I paid the $10 copay for it, because I guess in my head, I'm thinking I would rather have the medications and not need it than need the medications in the future for whatever reason and have to fight to try to get the prescription. Or worse, wait for the doctor's appointment to get the prescription when I could go ahead and already have them. So this is past me helping out future me, is the way I look at it. So that's a little macro level for some of you all. Like, if you go in, maybe go ahead and just ask for some of these prescriptions and say, "I'm not really sure, but I would like to try X, Y, and Z." Dr. Thompson and myself came up with a really good, like, I remember us having a sheet of paper and writing down all the medications that I had heard from other Nutcracker individuals. And we said, "Okay, what we're going to do is, step one, I'll prescribe these three, and then we're going to have a follow-up appointment in a week." And we would talk about it, and then we would go to, like, step two, and he might prescribe, like, I might be like, "Oh, this one didn't work, let's add this one." So we always kind of had a stepwise process. So don't, like, my primary care, I would come in and be like, "Here's this long list of drugs that I would like to try." Obviously, I'm not asking to do them all at once, but so what I'm giving you today is not necessarily a you should do. I'm not, this isn't prescriptive. This is just saying, I am somebody who was diagnosed with Nutcracker. I just 4.5 months ago had my kidney auto transplant. I am no longer on a lot of these medications because I am doing so much better post kidney auto transplant. But these were the things that did help me. So it's not saying you have to do them. It's not shaming you that if you did try them and they didn't work for your body, that something's wrong with you. Okay. There is nothing wrong with you. My biology and my body and the way that my body reacts to drugs is different than everybody else's. So I'm very aware of it's nuanced. What I'm hoping this episode will do is provide you all with maybe some cookie crumbs to follow. Maybe you didn't know. I remember some of these drugs. If somebody else wouldn't have told me, I would have had no clue to ask for them. So let's get started. I have done a previous episode on the Nutcracker Syndrome podcast where, and let me find what this episode is. It's episode 14 on hormones and vascular compressions, where I talk about some of the conversations I've had with my hormone specialist. And the possible connection between finding your way into the menopause journey, your hormones tanking, and that maybe leading to a higher probability of these vascular compressions becoming symptomatic. So, in the process of my vascular compressions, my Mayþerner and my Nutcracker, prior to them being treated, I went and got my hormones tested, and we found out that I had two deficiencies. One was my testosterone, it was tanked. My thyroid as well. I'm not hypothyroid, but I have something called T3 syndrome, low T3 syndrome, sorry. And that basically means that I don't necessarily have like a, I'm not hypo or hyperthyroidism. I don't have Hashimoto's or any of that. But something to do with my T3. So there's TSH, T3, T4. My T3 struggling, people. So I went on a thyroid medication, and my pill literally just says NP thyroid. So everybody's like, "Oh, are you on this thyroid medication? Are you on that thyroid medication?" And I'm like, "No, dog, I'm not." And let me find this bottle. It literally says thyroid NP. And it's 30 milligrams, and I take it twice a day. So, I can't even really tell you all. I don't even know the names of other thyroid medications. So, my thyroid medication is literally called thyroid. LOL. I take 60 milligrams out of daily. And then for my testosterone, I've been playing around with it for a bit. At the time of diagnosis, I decided to do pellets because I just was like, I don't need another thing to remember to do every day. On top of all the other pills that I'm taking. So I did pellets up to the time of the surgery. And then I actually just switched to a cream that I do daily. And that cream is, I believe it's like 5 milligrams. I actually don't have it with me, but it's a lower dosage. Maybe for some of you out there, if you're curious, like why did you switch, go from the pellets to the cream? I started out with a pretty conservative, like 100 milligrams of testosterone pellets. I felt like that was a good amount, but I also couldn't suss out whether the testosterone was making me have the heart palpitations, was my anxiety, was the vascular compressions. That was really hard. Going into my surgery, I upped it to 125 milligrams because there's a lot of research that shows that testosterone helps with healing. So I thought, you know what? I'm going into a major, major surgery. I'm going to need a little bit more testosterone just for my body to just nom, 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 nom. Just eat that testosterone up and help with healing. After I felt amazing, but there came this plateau. Like once my body basically did that initial healing process, I was like, ooh, this is too much testosterone. So I go in and talk to my hormone specialist and I say, you know what? I actually was either thinking of going to 75 milligram pellets, but you have to remember pellets are not remember. This is me reminding you, or maybe you remembering if you listen to that episode, that pellets are not covered by insurance. So it's $400 a pop, at least at my hormone specialist place. Don't come at me if you're like, what? I got it cheaper here. Okay, cool. Every 3 to 4 months. Okay. So I just decided, let me go one that's cheaper. So when I transition to the cream, I now pay 90 something dollars every 3 months versus 400. So gotta cut costs, gotta pay medical bills. So the cream is something you put on every morning and it has, I think it's half-life or its half-life is 5 hours. So meaning that like if you put it in on the morning, testosterone is a stimulant, so it'll give you that energy that you need, but you'll start kind of waning towards the end of the day. And you have to kind of do that cycle. So you're kind of, if you're looking at a graph, you're kind of like going up and then coming down, going up, coming down. Whereas the pellets are more of a consistent, like you go up and you kind of stay up, which is why they're the preferred method. Plus, you're not having to remember to do something daily. But those were the first things I got in check. So I want to just kind of circle back around to episode 14, talk about those hormones. If you are somebody, my recommendation would be if you are some anybody in your 30s, male, female, if you are in your 30s, just go get that baseline hormone panel checked. Your th full panel thyroid, full panel testosterone, your estradiol, your progesterone for women, and just do the whole gambit. I think I got my vitamin D, some other things, kind of DHEA as well. Those can just give you a little bit of a snapshot because something we have to remember is when our body is going through stress, and you know what I'm going to do here? I actually teach a psychology of injury course, and I read something yesterday in our lecture that was very profound. And I was like, oh my gosh, I need to share this with all my Nutcracker people. So let me lock in here to my textbook. And this to me was just, I highlighted the whole, it says, physiologically, the human body is designed to treat any stressor. So that would include, this is obviously in the context of the psychology of sport injury, but any stressor would be a diagnosis such as Nutcracker syndrome and subsequent treatment as a threat. Okay, so instigated by the hypothalamus and known as the fight or flight response, the human body responds to threats by releasing hormones such as adrenaline and cortisol, resulting in a stress response aimed to protect the body from possible harm. This surge of adrenaline will prepare the body for a fight, categorized by increased heart rate, replenished energy supplies, and elevated blood pressure. Is this starting to sound familiar to anybody? Because it is to me. Cortisol will prepare your body to focus on what is to come by suppressing non-essential bodily systems such as, resonate here, digestive and reproductive systems, increasing glucose in the bloodstream, and activating the brain to use more glucose. Cortisol also activates the body's natural emergency room by ensuring it has enough substances available for tissue repair if slash when necessary. So the fight or flight response also communicates with the brain, affecting the individual's thoughts and emotions. It's why we feel crazy, particularly fear in numerous other mood states. My God. So this absolutely resonated with me because it's releasing these hormones. It's releasing adrenaline and cortisol. So our hormonal system is, if it's affecting the adrenaline and cortisol, it's affecting the estradiol, the testosterone, the thyroid. When I actually recorded the hormone and vascular compression episode 14, I hadn't gotten my results back yet. And looking back, I'm like, ooh, I wish I would have waited. I just got too excited. I actually went from prior to my Nutcracker treatment, my kidney auto transplant, I was considered perimenopausal. So for some of you that aren't fully aware of the menopausal states, there's three stages. There is premenopausal, peri, and menopausal, and then a fourth stage is postmenopausal. So I was perimenopausal. My numbers were wacko, got on the thyroid, did all this stuff. I went back and decided, you know what? I'm going to go do more blood testing and actually see, now that my blood is pumping properly, where are my hormones at? And sure enough, now I've only supplemented with my thyroid, I've only supplemented my testosterone, but my estradiol numbers. So I was not, I want to repeat, I did not do any estradiol, I did not do any progesterone, hormone replacement therapy at all. I decided I did not want to at the time. I have endometriosis, which can be fueled by estrogen. I didn't want to add fuel to the flame by putting estradiol on there, and progesterone in any form has never helped me. So I go and get retested, and sure enough, my numbers are more balanced. I am a 35-year-old woman now. This whole process started when I was 33, and I aged backwards. I don't know how else to say it. I feel like, you know, call that marketing of the year. Kidney auto transplant made me younger. I went from being perimenopausal to now I'm just premenopausal, which makes a little bit more sense for my age. Now, that's not to say people that are 35 aren't necessarily peri and that there's something wrong with it. But I really did feel like this diagnosis and lead up to the treatment just aged the shit out of me. So, wanted to bring this in, talking about hormones from a medication standpoint. Now, that's hormones. Listen to episode 14 if you would like to hear just a little bit more about that. I go into some of the more details that I spoke with my specialist about on the mechanism that's there, on how hormones can potentially affect our vascular system and these compressions. Now, the next ones are I'm going to go into three different kind of subsets and then one kind of final one that y'all might giggle about. So I'm going to start off with anti-anxiety. And then actually, let's see. I'm going to start out with anti-anxiety. So I'm going to encourage you to ask your primary care doc about an anti-anxiety regimen while you are dealing with potentially one of the more stressful things you've ever dealt with. Definitely one of the most stressful things I've ever dealt with. I didn't actually go in asking for this. Thankfully, Dr. Thompson was like, "How are you doing anxiety-wise?" And I was like, "I'm doing okay. I kind of brushed it off. I mean, I'm a psych professor. I teach meditation. I'm like, I have a lot of tools in the toolbox." And he was like, "Okay, well, I was just going to see maybe if you might need an anti-anxiety medication." And I'll be honest with you, I had some bias. I was like, "I don't need that." And then I went back. I'm pointing myself in the head right now. I went back to what I said at the beginning of this episode, and I said, "Listen, we have to make sure that we just say yes." So we started me on two separate types of anti-anxiety med. We first did a review. I took the GAD-7, the General Anxiety Disorder 7 test. I scored severe anxiety at first. So we started on a midline anti-anxiety, which is buspirone. We started at 5 milligrams to see if I even liked it. And then from there, we upped it to 10 milligrams 3 times daily. That very much worked for me in the beginning. So I would probably say 3, 4 months out from my kidney autotransplant. Then, as the transplant got closer and it was like I had a surgery date on, I was accepted by UW Health, the whole thing, I started having night terrors, you name it. So I go in and I'm like, "Listen, Dr. Thompson, the buspirone, chef's kiss, love it. Is there like a heavier hitter that we can supplement with?" So then he prescribed me clonazepam, which is the off-brand of Klonopin, and it was 0.5 milligrams as needed. And then so again, if I started having panic attacks, anxiety attacks, sometimes I just felt like, okay, the buspirone is not really enough, so I might pop a clonazepam, mostly at night. I would say for me, again, it was as needed. So I would maybe do that once, twice a week. When we were getting closer to the surgery date, maybe 3, 4 times. And then after the surgery, I don't really do it that much anymore. I mean, I did once I was getting my kidney stones, but it's definitely less needed. So I'm gonna encourage you to be kind to yourself. Some of my bias was like, I don't want to go on anti-anxiety. There's all these kind of like clonazepam does have an addictive effect. So the buspirone does not, which is why I felt comfortable going on it. Again, you can also just decide to stop taking the medication. Nobody's shoving it down your throat. You can decide to go pick it up and then never take it. So have complete autonomy here. To me, the anti-anxiety is what we are going through is so stressful, not only because it's a severe diagnosis with a potentially severe treatment option, but the majority of the medical community doesn't even know what this is. So, talk about loneliness, and that definitely leads to anxiety for me. So, anti-anxiety also helped me with my blood pressure. I felt like it kept my blood pressure down, so it actually helped my symptoms. So when I started taking buspirone, I was like, "Oh, my symptoms are actually more at bay. I don't feel like I'm in a flare as often," which can be a thing. Anti-anxiety medication can help with pain management. Okay, and it did for me. Then I went into anticonvulsants. Okay, now that sounds aggressive, but that's what the category of this type of drug is. And I know this is, I'm going to say this word, and some of y'all immediately are going to be like, "No." But gabapentin I'm a fan of gabapentin. I at first wasn't. I saw a lot of people talk about how this drug either didn't help them at all, like that it didn't have an effect. So I was like, I'm not gonna waste my time. But I did have another Nutcracker bestie that was like, I started gabapentin. I feel like it's really helping me. So I was like, you know what? Back to my rule of just requesting it, going and getting it, and then I can take it. And if it doesn't work, stop taking it. So Dr. Thompson prescribed me with gabapentin. The prescription was 300 milligrams 3 times daily. And I started this 1.5 months out from the surgery date. And this, in combination with my anti-anxiety meds, helped me tremendously get to the finish line. For context, I'm a professor. My surgery was December 19th. Final grades were due December 17th. So the week leading up to the surgery, which also included us needing to drive out to Madison, Wisconsin from the Denver, Colorado area, was me grading 80 10-page papers. So that's 800 pages of papers, not including title page, table of contents, references. You know, please send good energy my way. Like, I was so stressed, and I felt like this gabapentin kept me upright. And what I mean by that is, I would wake up in the morning in pain. I would take my anti-anxiety and my gabapentin at the same time. When it would become lunchtime, for example, I would start to decline and be like, oh no, I don't know if I can finish my day. I'd go pop a gabapentin because I need to take it 3 times daily, and I would be back on track. It was just like, I was so aware that this gabapentin was keeping me upright. So know that gabapentin is an option. It helped me a lot. I felt like it helped more so my nerve pain. I felt like a lot of my reflux blood was like causing pressure on particular nerve bundles. And so there was that. It did help with my left renal vein, and my left flank pain. So you have the anti-anxiety, you have the anti-convulsants. So we have the anti-anxiety being the buspirone and the clonazepam, and then the gabapentin. Now, another heavy hitter for me was muscle relaxers. A lot of my symptoms were musculoskeletal, given that I had a lot of collaterals that were going up into my chest plus into my spine. So I tried a couple different muscle relaxers over the years. My gynecologist started me on methocarbamol at 500 milligrams as needed. Over time, I just felt like it wasn't doing anything. Over time, I started taking two, so it'd be like 1,000 milligrams, which I knew was safe because they had prescribed that to me in the ER and said that it was fine. But I didn't like that I was having to like double up on pills. That just didn't feel right to me. So then I go to Dr. Thompson. I'm like, hey, methocarbamol doesn't feel like it's working for me. What are my other options? He then prescribed me first tizanidine, which I always, whenever I take that out, I'm like, tizanidine. Which maybe you're not laughing at that, but it makes me giggle. I'm about to sneeze. Oh, blessings to everybody. He started me on tizanidine. Oh, here we go again. Okay. Oh my gosh. It's allergy season, people. He started me on tizanidine at 2 milligrams as needed. It felt very similar to methocarbamol. It just wasn't doing anything. I noticed that I was taking two pills at a time to try to get any type of effect. I didn't like that. So I actually asked him, I said, listen, the majority of the time I take the muscle relaxers is at night to help me go to sleep. So that's when we transitioned to cyclobenzaprine at 10 milligrams as needed. And that is the bread and butter for me, is the cyclobenzaprine. It has a drowsy effect, so it's definitely not something, unless you're trying to take a nap during the day, which I've done this before. The cyclobenzaprine very much helped me. So again, probably like the methocarbamol didn't really, it helped me at first post-hysterectomy, then very much hit a plateau. Tizanidine, same thing. So my really, like, I started out with the buspirone, gabapentin, cyclobenzaprine combo, and then I added in that clonazepam closer to, so I was still doing the buspirone, added the clonazepam as needed, gabapentin, cyclobenzaprine. So four heavy hitters there for me on top of my hormones. And then as far as pain medication goes, I tried my damnedest to stay away from specific pain medications like ibuprofen. Like, even though my kidney function was definitely declining, but it wasn't too bad. So they were like, you can get away with ibuprofen every now and then, but I was trying to stay away with those as much as possible. So the four that I just told you were kind of my pain med combo. But I did have, and you bet your britches that I had some oxycodone, 5 milligrams as needed, and I would take it when I needed it. But it was very much, I would probably say I was taking an oxy once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, because I really felt like the kind of the heavy hitter four that I just told you was really helping me. I did notice when I was around time of my menstruation, if I was after sex or if I'd exercised too much, exercise mean walking too much, such as going to the grocery store. I did get to where I was using one of those like motorized scooters a lot to help with pain management. So I might up my oxy a little bit after that, as far as like maybe I would take it twice a week, depending on what the week was. And then lastly, I'll end with, and this to me, I felt like is more just kind of like comical, but we all need a good stool softener, don't we? I mean, can we just get a round of applause for a quality stool softener? I use a, you know, everybody's love and joy, Colace. I'm, you know, a cheap bitch, so I would oftentimes just like I'm literally looking at Colace, but it's the Equate version from Walmart. Stool softener with a stimulant laxative. That last part was vital for me. I don't know about any of you all, but if it doesn't have the stimulant laxative, it's basically like it did nothing for me. So, what I'm hoping, those are the medications that helped me. I am going to put in the show notes the medications that I took and the dosage that I took. Obviously, the dosage is going to be dependent upon your body. So the doctor can kind of have a little bit more there for you. But that way, because we all know how drugs are, you're like, how the frig do you spell that? Don't you worry. Just go to the show notes and you'll be able to see how it's spelled. Again, this is my lived experience. These medications worked for me. It does not mean that they will work for you, and or if they didn't work for you, I do not want to invalidate your experience. If you feel so inclined, throw some other medications in the comments that could help people out to realize, oh, I can ask for this and it could help. So, as always, I hope that this episode was very helpful for you. I want to end again by, let's just take a moment, take that big, deep breath. In through your nose, out through your mouth. And then another one at your own pace, maybe even hold it at the top for a moment, and then more slowly. Feeling more grounded in this moment. You are doing the best you can with what you have. I'm so proud of you. Take a moment to just send gratitude to yourself. Keep with this breathing pattern for the next couple moments if you have it, as you maybe transition into the next episode or for whatever you have going on with your day. But just know that you're not alone in this journey.